for the recorder, just to identify who the voices are for the transcriptionist, and that's to say that this is an interview with Robert Naughton by David Brock, taking place in Saratoga, California, on January the 24th, I guess it is today, 2007. And Dr. Naughton, I thought I would begin by just asking you very basic questions about when and where you were born exactly.
Yes, I was born October 13th, 1928, in Stockton, California.
And had your family been in California for some time?
Some time, yes. As far as we can go back on my mother's side, as an Italian family, they came here in the 1790s.
Wow. To Northern California?
Northern California, right. From Chiavari in Italy.
And was her family, was your mother's family involved with agriculture?
Agriculture at that time, near Sonora.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And could you tell me a little bit more about what you know about that? Or?
Well, the two brothers arrived there apparently in 1790, and they were felt to be two separate families. One was in the southern part of Sonora, the other was in the northern part. And unfortunately, they intermarried, because that's all the people that were there. And so that the last generation with Uncle Louie and Aunt Dolly, which had been great-great aunts and uncles, they had no other children. And they had two girls, and they did not want to adopt anybody, so that the family just sort of... There are some distant relatives still up there. We heard from some lady who worked in the bank. She said, oh, no, they come in all the time, Volpone. So, and that's the family name. It's V-O-L-P-O-N, either with an I or E. And that's where the confusion occurred.
Ah.
And I remember that some of the crops that they had, particularly cherries, and my dad and I would go over and pick one cherry and eat two, and that ended up with an upset stomach.
And what about your father's side?
My father's side was Irish, and they came through two areas. One was Ellis Island, and our name is there at Ellis Island. And then they went across the Sioux Indian country to Butte, Montana, in mining. They were in mining. And then my father came to California. And so a common Catholic marriage in California at that time was Irish and Italian.
And what brought your father to Northern California?
He ended up we had a mine, actually, up in the Sierra, a very small mine. And that got us through the Depression. And then he went into more civil engineering with construction work. He was the chief on building the linear accelerator at Stanford. So,
oh.
And the United Technologies Missile Center down here in below San Jose. So he did a lot of big construction.
Did he have an engineering education?
Yes, he had some. He was at the State School of Mines, Montana State School of Mines, and then he went to Berkeley for a short time.
And was it a metals mine then?
Gold mine, yes.
It was a gold mine.
Gold mine, yes.
And did you, for how long... For how much of your childhood was the mine sort of an active concern?
We went through the fourth grade. There was no kindergarten then, and the school was in Maloney's, California. And I met my teacher, who had educated us through the first four grades. She settled down here, and the school was closed. And there were 15 children in eight grades. That was it.
One-room schoolhouse?
Oh, very much one-room.
And so was it a quite rural area then?
Very rural. There was a mine that wasn't really producing much in that area, and that was the only industry that they had. And Dad and my grandfather Doherty, who was my mother's father, used to go over, and I used to go over with them. They had one of those pumper things on the railroad track, and go over, and they would mine the, they would take the ore, and then when they, after finished crushing it, then they would put it on a concentrator table with mercury, which would dissolve the gold. And then they would take the gold, and why we didn't come down with mercury poisoning, I don't know, but they would fry it in a frying pan to drive off the mercury, and then take that gold into Sonora. And that was our income.
And so, did you have siblings, older siblings who were working?
I was the oldest father.
Okay.
Yeah, I have three sisters and a brother.
Right. So was it your grandfather, your father, were they the two people principally working?
Two principal people, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you have, so you lived there until... You say through the fourth grade. So that's around age 10 or so?
Right. And then we moved to San Andreas for a year. And it was a huge school. There were 300 kids in 8 grades. So nothing like things. And then we moved down onto the peninsula just before World War II. And we lived in Woodside.
Okay.
For 2 years there. And then we moved to San Carlos. And when we were in San Carlos is when I went to Sequoia.
Okay. So you were in Woodside for sort of middle school or junior high school?
They didn't have middle schools then, and
yeah.
I was there for the... 6th and 7th grade.
Okay.
And it was a tiny school. I don't remember the numbers, but it was a very tiny school. It was one room school.
So let me just see here. If you can... So did the Depression really make much of an impact on you and your family...
Well, you see, when you're living at that level, you don't have anything to compare it with. So you don't know whether it's good or bad, it's just that that's what you had. We did have NRA stickers on our window, and we had a radio, but the electricity, there were several companies trying to become what eventually was PG&E, and they were terrible people. They would blow up transformers, they would cut down trees, was like... And so we didn't have a lot of electricity very often. One broadcast I heard was Orson Welles' Wars of the World, and we were all not sure. If you'd heard the beginning, it said that this was
right.
Not true, but that's one of the few. We didn't get much of that. We heard some of the fireside chats. We lived in a wooden structure that was what they called a bunkhouse. Was there a few? There was a store across the street, but bought very little. Grew most of our own stuff, vegetables, fruits, what have you.
What were sort of the emphases in your household growing up? Let's say before the time you moved to the peninsula religion, or what was...
Well, the first of all, the easiest thing is the religion. There was no church in the town. And the whole time when we were there, we went there when I was about 18 months old, we had... there were no movies. One came to town, I think it was Will Rogers' movies, I remember, and nobody could afford to go, so it was didn't work. But that was the only time in all of those years. And one of our biggest activities was, of course, going to school. We would walk to school and what have you. But there was no dance halls, there were no saloons, none of the usual kinds of things, and there was a limited number of people living there.
Was there a library of any sort?
No, that was something that created an interesting mess for me in the eighth grade. But
What was that mess?
Well, this is when the Stanford Binet test came out. And that's based on literature. And we really didn't have literature either in the school or else. We learned reading, writing, arithmetic kind of thing, basic, that was it. And so that when it first appeared in the late 30s down here, the Sequoia used it to decide what you're going to do in school. And there were three of us who took it at that time and completely failed it. And so that they had a rating that was 2-2, you'd done everything perfectly. 1-2, 2-1, 1-1. The 2-2 was essentially a retarded kind of thing. And I was a 2-2 going into high school. And I mentioned to the counselor that I was going to, wanted to be a doctor. And of course she knew that I was going to be flunking out in the first semester. So I never got, in the first year, I never got any pre-college courses, with one exception, and that was English. And the English teacher had the three of us and said, I don't believe that there's something wrong here. I know these kids. So she had me tested, along with the other two fellows, on a non-literature basis, and of course, you know, we get enormous IQs out of this, and she took them. And the librarian, who was our counselor, didn't care. She knew what was wrong. Her husband was the teacher in math, the English teacher. And he put us in advanced math classes as freshmen in high school. And then took the results down to her again. And it was crazy. So when we came to getting recommended for college, it didn't occur, and so my dad knew the chancellor up at UC, and he went up there to find out. So then he went back down to the principal of the school and said, what's a 2-2? I had every honor the school gave us. The three of us who were retarded graduated 1, 2, 3 in the class out of 700. He says, oh, Norman, we get those occasionally. But the big problem is that they don't make it beyond the first semester because they just can't do anything. And he says, you're talking about my son. And so then when we got accepted to UC, we had to live in Richmond. And that's when Gordon and I, he wasn't one of the three. And he... we realized that we lived in Richmond, we'd been commuting all day long to and from classes, so we went to San Jose State. But, I always tell the same story about being a 2-2.
So you did your first 2 years also at San Jose State?
We both went together. In fact, he had a flatbed, I think it was a Model A truck, and, we would take off every morning, go down there, and come back every day. So it was great.
And then, just to loop back then in time to just your impressions maybe before high school when you're living in...
Hi, is Jeannie there?
When you moved down to the peninsula and we're living in Woodside. Mm-hmm. And just your impressions of the area, what Woodside was like, what the surrounding area was like.
We at that time, Woodside was strictly a summer home place for people who lived in San Francisco. And so we rented a house in the Woodside Glens, and we walked from there to school all the time. And it was essentially a very rural area. The famous barn that's there, that's a Tudor thing on Highway 1, was there when I was going there. We'd walk by it every morning going to school. And the school was on the road that went up to La Hacienda. Yeah.
And you mentioned that by the time that you got to high school, you already knew that you were interested in becoming a doctor. Could you talk a little bit about how you knew
actually,
that?
Actually, I knew that when I was 10 years old. My dad was working in when we moved to San Andreas, and he was working in an assayer's office, which was a common thing then for mining, and he took a cardboard box and just threw it up on top of, empty, threw it up on top of a filing cabinet and got a fractured dislocation of his neck. His head just fell back. And there was a Dr. John Brown, I remember him, young doctor, just arrived in town, and this was usually a fatal type of thing. And just marvelous. He just took care of me, recovered completely, no paralysis. And I thought, that's a kind of a neat way to live. And I wanted to become a doctor, and I wanted to go to UC Berkeley. Of course, there was only one UC there.
How did your mind fix on UC Berkeley?
Well, we had lived in Oakland for a very short time when I was right after I was born. And then we lived in Stockton and Oakland and moved up to Sierra to get through the Depression. And so I knew about Berkeley, and I guess maybe it was the major. I didn't even think about Stanford.
And as you were going through school, did you find that study came easy to you, that, you know, you were performing well academically?
Yeah, we, when I say the three of us, we finally got into reasonable classes, and we essentially graduated with straight A's for all high school. And it wasn't hard for us. We got assigned, it was hilarious, we got assigned to a addition and subtraction math course. And they had a book from the Navy. And could we, and this is probably what we're going to be using for several years. And the instructor also was saying, something's wrong here. And so not understanding that, we finished it that weekend. Just finished it and turned it in. Then they didn't know what the hell to do with this. And that's how we ended up in geometry and algebra early. But it was never, academics was never a problem for us.
And so you graduated at the top of your
right,
class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And were you and Gordon Moore in the same class then? The same year in
yes,
school?
Yes, right. We were in the same year. He lived in Redwood City, and his friend, well, I think he may have come over from Pescadero before then, but when he was living in Redwood City, wasn't close to us, and most of our friends were from San Carlos, which is the next small town up. And so then we would meet in different things, but we were not in the same classes together. I think he played football there for some time. I was called a manager in the football team, and that was really a water boy. So when I graduated from Sequoia, I was 5'1 and weighed 110 pounds. I was on a swim team, but I was a tiny guy.
Didn't Gordon Moore also do diving? Did you know one another in that connection?
He was doing the diving when I was doing the backstroke. Yeah.
Let's see, a couple different questions. How did you first meet Gordon Moore? How did you...
Probably with the swimming would be part of it. Those people I've gotten, have seen around here, they have settled around here. But I know that with the... when we started, it was the beginning of World War II in 1942. We were in high school. And so, 46, all of these guys would be coming back on GI Bill and going to college. And that was their, all of the colleges, universities, priority was to get those guys through school. And so that housing was impossible. And we came together on that. We both found out about having to live in, he was going to go to Berkeley too. We found out that we had to live in Richmond, and it was going to be a long commute both times. And we said, we didn't want to do that. So we went to San Jose.
Did Berkeley have some housing in Richmond?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah, they had student housing there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you think back to... in your high school experience together, then you had these common sporting activities. Were the both of you in the same sort of social group or clique?
No, we. I thought about that after I first talked with you. We were from two different towns and two different groups. There's about four of us from San Carlos who all went also to San Jose State. But only Gordon and I commuted in this truck. And it was just fun. And we continued to do that at Berkeley.
To commute in his truck?
No, he then got a Model B Ford. And I was so short, I could get up behind the driver because... this is when Betty entered the thing, and she, I guess it was an aunt in Berkeley, she was periodically ride with us. And it was a hilarious thing because we got into an accident on Bayshore driving back. And it was like a World War I movie. And... car ahead of us stopped suddenly, and we didn't stop. And the guy was drinking a chocolate milkshake while he was sitting on this freeway. And all of a sudden, it looked like there was blood all over the windshield inside. And we said, oh God, we killed somebody. And his father was the chief deputy sheriff of the county. And here we are being called off. The two of us with this young lady. I mean, my God, oh, this is horrible. Here we got this white slavery thing going on. And not really. But anyway, we were in the police station for quite some time before anybody confirmed the fact that, yes, that's right, his dad was the chief deputy sheriff. But I'll never forget that windshield inside. Boom. You know, oh, God, it's hilarious.
So... So how did it, tell me a little bit about what Sequoia High School was like during those years, how big it was.
Again, we had about 750 in our class. It was the primary high school for that whole Carlemont didn't exist, and Woodside didn't exist, so there was a single... high school, so everybody from that whole area came there. Rather diverse background. One of the things that did occur was the Japanese students were taken out of our classes and put into this internment thing. And that was an introduction to everything. And then we would have, at graduations during the war, people were wearing their uniforms to graduate, and they would just disappear into the thing. And one of the big hospitals out here was Dibble Hospital, which was up at Stamford area. And it was a big thing. I was very active in the student activities. I was the class vice president, and then I became president when the president left. And I ran the student council, and I participated in sports. Now, I'm not a big sports person, but it was a good time. It was a good time. We had good teachers, very good teachers, when we got the classes that we wanted to do. Once they found out we were serious about going to college, we couldn't take shops because we'd ruin our hands. And very, very diverse cultural group of people from all over the whole area.
Did socially, did things, did groups form according to where people lived?
Yeah, right. They
okay.
Did. So that's where the four of us from San Carlos pretty well stayed with
right.
themselves during the whole time.
I see. Well, could you talk a little bit more then about the impact of the Second World War on the school, on the community, on your family?
Well, we had a lot of things that occurred, and the most of the people killed at Pearl Harbor came from the Bay Area. And so a lot of animosity, a lot of bad feelings about the Japanese. And, oh, boy, I'll tell you. And so when it was decided to intern them, people talk now about how illegal that was. I know when we lived there as students, we were so angry at these people that I'm afraid that there may have been a mess if they had stayed. And that's not nice to say, but this is what was going on. And of course, we would lose friends, brothers, who were a year so old. And Dick Rossick's brother was killed in Guadalcanal. And that brought everything home to us. But there were just so many people who were killed at Pearl Harbor, the 3,000 or something. And then most of the not books written at that time were at various parts of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we had victory gardens, and somebody being upset about dropping the atomic bomb, and I was in Korea. I was at twice, and I was a Navy corpsman with the Marines, and that you have a lot of different thoughts about war.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, things were very short. Things were very short. I had my first job, besides the paper route thing, was working in Torito's Market in San Carlos. And I got paid 60 cents an hour. And I figured out that was a penny a minute. Boy, I was really living.
That was during high school?
That was during high school. And the manager was lived near us, and he would wrap up butter in plain paper and give it to us because it was rationed. Gasoline was rationed. You had a sticker that said how much you could get. Meat was really in short supply. But so we would grow a lot of stuff. One of the most miserable crops that we grew, though, were squash, zucchini squash, and we grew several heads of zucchini squash. God, I got sick of zucchini squash. But we were out in the backyard when the news reports were coming in from Pearl Harbor. And it really, I know my dad was very angry.
So by the end of your high school experience, you were still on track with your desire to go to medical school. And so was it just, how did it come to pass that, was it, did you and Gordon Moore see one another socially? So then to discuss this idea of going to San Jose State instead of Berkeley?
I think we just figured out this is what we had to do. And I don't remember the details as to, because I was very close to this group from San Carlos.
Right.
The two brothers and the other fellows, and these people were in my when we got married. And it was a, I think it was a necessity kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Found out that we weren't going to go live in Richmond, and even though we had been accepted at Cal, but we wanted to, so this worked out. He had this truck. And we tried living down there one time. I know I lived there for, I think, a quarter or something. And it just, it was more than I could afford. So we came back to the truck again.
Okay. And how would you, in those 2 years, I guess, commuting together to San Jose State, did Gordon Moore ever talk at that time about wanting to become a chemist? Did you guys ever talk about chemistry?
We didn't talk much about... at that time, you still had what our goals were, and he took primarily math, physics, and chemistry. And a big thing at San Jose State at that time, they had a wonderful math department. And they dove into that very well, and so that we were trying to get, well, I call it basic ed out here now, out of the way. And I thought I had it out of the way, and I finished my associate's degree. And then at the end of my senior year in Berkeley, they reminded me that I needed another social program, so I decided to take math. And the mistake I made was not taking the graduate student lady, date her in order to take the class. And I didn't understand that requirement, so I didn't do well in that class. But mostly it was just getting through the requirements. And it was a very busy campus, as they all were. All the veterans came back. A lot of guys just weren't qualified to go. And they started, and they didn't make it. But books were very expensive. We never bought books before. One of the big things at that time was slide rules. And they were terribly expensive. I'm trying to learn how to run them. But we took a lot of parallel courses. I did take a lot of chemistry courses. He did put together... He loved explosions. He put together... some stuff from one of the chemistry classes. It came table near it. It was so unstable. It would go pop, 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 pop. And the instructor was a little upset about that.
Did you guys sometimes commute down on the train? Was there rail service down? Or?
I don't remember doing that, really. I remember taking the train occasionally. I remember the one thing about the train that I never forgot was Harry Truman was president, and he came through San Jose, and I was closer than you are to him. He was standing on the back of this thing, you know, in the car, and I remember I was right in front of the crowd, and I looked up at him, and I thought, oh, wow, and he looked like a president. He really did, and I'll never forget that. That was really something. The only president I've ever seen.
Did you get to know were you and Gordon more just sort of commuting pals, or did you have a friendship that developed at that time?
Well, we developed a friendship, and then at the end of the 2 years when we decided we were going up to Cal, we decided we were going to live together the same place, and that was a big step too for us both, because we hadn't even thought about it at that point.
How would you describe him, Gordon Moore, during high school and during those San Jose State years? Was he quiet? Was he
several
the guy?
Things. He has said himself that he really didn't work very hard in high school, but he was a very studious guy. When he got down with the classes he took, he was doing very well in them. And when we got to Berkeley, he took about again the same three classes, basically it was math and physics and chemistry, and he was a good student with that. He was a quiet kind of guy, but he would, I think we were at State or Cal, I'm not sure. He belonged to the Rocket Society. So one day he and I set off this rocket, and the thing went completely out of sight. We don't know how high it ever went. And we were at his house. And in came his father. Father was livid. Something about screwing around with the rockets or something. It came down and went through a two-story house, went through the top story, through the bottom story, and exploded in the living room. Nobody got hurt, but he knew that there was only two people who could have done that. So nothing ever came of it. And he had this rocket engine that he had designed on his desk at Berkeley. And that was the first Rocket Society, and that, you know, that's back in the 40s.
Did you get to know his family during this time period? Did you meet it sounds like you were over at his house. Did you meet his parents?
Yeah, I knew his parents. His mother was a very quiet lady, very nice lady. His father was too, but he also was very much of a lawful, obviously lawful kind of guy, being chief deputy sheriff. And he, lent me a 45 to go to Korea on my second trip over. And he was just, he also was a quiet kind of a guy, not a bombastic, not a politician type guy. He was very nice.
Was he somewhat imposing? I got the impression that he was sort of a somewhat imposing figure.
Well, he's a big person.
Yeah.
He's a big person, and in his uniform, yeah, but I knew him from a different way, so he didn't seem imposing to me. There's some hilarious stories. Was in Woodside, he and his deputies would go up there during the deer season to be sure that these guys weren't going to shoot up the whole area. And somebody stopped and asked him where their deers were, and he said, "Oh, there's a lot up there, but you'll have trouble getting over the fence," and let it go. Shortly after that, here comes this guy with this big doe, male deer draped over the hood, and said, "Thanks a lot. But boy, did I have trouble getting over the fence." What he had to do was to go up to the headwaters for Crystal Springs Reservoir. It's all reserved. You can't go in there. He climbed over that fence, shot this deer, which was right next to the fence, and brought it back. Well, his father couldn't arrest the guy or anything because he told him where to go.
And did you get to know Gordon Moore's brothers at all?
There's two. One, I took care of his youngest brother's children.
Huh.
one down here in practice, and then they got divorced and they disappeared. His brother, the other one who lived in Pescadero area, was actually a farmer in agriculture, and very pleasant guy, and I met him maybe one or two times, but that's about all.
Did you get to know Betty Moore at all at San Jose State?
No, I don't know. That's one thing that I thought about when considering all these things. I know when she came into the picture was when we were going to Berkeley, because she would drive up with us. I don't know how they met. But Betty and Gordon have known each other longer than my wife and I. We were married 53 years, so.
What was your, when you met her during those Berkeley years, what was your impression of her?
Well, she was a nice gal. She was a tiny gal. And of course, my own wife is only 4'11", so I was shocked. And he was courting her and doing all of this kind of academic work and doing superb academic work. I was always amazed by that. And she went to the senior ball with him, and I had gone with somebody else, and we had not dated much at all. And Betty was new in the whole thing. We were not big daters, even in high school.
When you, one other question about, before we get into Berkeley. You mentioned that your father had gone to speak with the chancellor. How did the two of them know one another?
They were classmates.
Oh.
He didn't finish 4 years of college, and he had gone to Montana School, State School of Mines. He was at Gonzaga with Bing Crosby. And they told Crosby he had a lousy voice, he might as well quit what you're doing, you know. But, and then he got to Berkeley, I don't know how long he was there, but this was one of his classmates.
I see. So then it would have been, around 1948 that you guys
started? We went to Berkeley, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you were there until around 1950. Were you quite occupied with the sort of pre-med program then?
Yeah, right. The pre-med program, you could take a degree in chemistry or zoology. All I had to do was take one course either way in my senior year. And pre-med was really competitive then, really wanting to go. This was their last shot.
And so in what way was it competitive, just very hard coursework?
Well, the numbers of people applying for the number of places available.
Oh.
And the GI students, this was going to be their last chance to get into medical school.
I see.
Yeah.
And So was it at this time that Gordon Moore talked about wanting to become a chemist as a career choice?
He was taking I don't remember him using the term chemist. I just don't. That doesn't mean he didn't, but his whole direction was that way. But he talked, as we got into our senior year, we were talking about where he was going to go, and he was going to go down to Caltech.
And did the two of you live together for both those years?
Both years, yeah. We lived on the north campus, right above the Newman Club, right on the edge of one block from the campus. All of mine was down to LSB, Life Science Building, way down in the front of the campus, and looked like the Pentagon. And his was up on the other end. And so we were going all the time to those things. And we had the craziest landlady in the world, and she wanted to make it clear that we were not to use Lifebuoy soap because she didn't like the color that was left in the showers. It was just too much. I mean, I still remember her. And she ran the place. It was really old. And the mattresses were padded foxholes. The worst kids I've ever
had. And this was the co-op? Was it a co-op?
No, we ate. The co-op is how we got through.
Okay.
Well, the co-op was probably the way that most of the students, large number, got through college with board and room. Some lived in the place. We didn't. You won't believe this, but our bill was $26 a month for food. And we weren't, there was no room to get into Klein Court, which was near us, so we ate there all the time. And then, of course, we were real neophytes when we arrived, so we got assigned the central kitchen, and that's where we were doing pot washing. And then after that, I ended up hashing, serving on the tables, and then the senior year, though, I got a better job. I was painting. I had to paint, and I was painting the inside of the women's dorms, you know, that was a very much kind of thing. But we got good food, you had so many hours to work, and it was well done, and he gave a very large contribution to the co-op. Whole thing. I think it was something like almost $100,000. So that, and that, you know, that sort of defines him. Thing I can't emphasize enough about him is that, yes, he had a lot of money, but he gives it by the tons away to people, to very good things. But it's the most amazing thing that you don't see people doing that anymore. And I'm aware of many of his contributions. But the co-ops really took good care of us.
So were your rooms part of the co-op, or they were
there were about three rooms in this dilapidated house just above the co-op.
Okay.
It was not part of the co-op, no.
And so did you share a room, or did
you... We shared a room.
I see.
We had two beds in the room, and we had a separate bathroom, shower, what have you. Yeah.
And what were... I know he was, at the time, he was... well, you both must have been quite busy with your studies, mm-hmm. But did you have any common hobbies or activities? Or
we didn't have common ones, but we did participate in a lot of the things. The big thing at that time, in fact, Cal went to the Rose Bowl 2 years we were there. And I won't forget the first time. We went down on a train, and these two lovely co-eds came up and wanted to know if we would like to play bridge. Well, we could play pinochle, but we didn't know how to play bridge. I said, oh, God, of all the skills that we needed. And then we went to eat in a Chinese restaurant, and he had ordered a steak, and it was so tough, it was unreal. He tried to cut it, and it was airborne. Just went across the... But I had another classmate who was also pre-med, and we went out on the old red trolleys to Pasadena, and we went to the Rose Bowl then. It was quite a time, but in fact, the big game, we even took my dad with his snow-white hair, with his cap on, to sit in the rooting section, and the rooters were just wonderful. They thought it was great. They were always going to pass them around and got him in there. And, it was special. We didn't participate in the riots that went on at that time. The city got all upset because when they went with the float by the reviewing stand, they just pumped water on all the dignitaries. And then there was an ice cream truck that was going up Bancroft and it was spilling gasoline out of a full tank all the way down the bottom. And people didn't know that. And they built a bonfire and it went shoop, under the truck. And the guy is passing out all of the ice cream just to get rid of it. And so this, and then the next thing, the fire department arrives and they had a red engine. Well, you can't have a red engine at Berkeley. So they painted it blue and gold. So that one riot was, I think, 48, but it was just too much.
So as, are there any other stories from those Berkeley years of Gordon Moore or of the two of you that come to mind?
Well, we would usually drive home on the weekends. We didn't spend time on the weekends, and that's how we avoided the first riot that the city really came down on Cal. And at the same time, of course, Betty was very active in this part, and she would drive back to us periodically. She was raised over here in Campbell.
Yeah.
And but we would go to the basketball games and that kind of thing, you know, but not, we didn't join into all the big kinds of things. We were mostly tied up with what we were doing.
In a way, now you were coming home on the weekends and you would stay with your family?
Yeah.
You personally?
Yeah, right.
And similarly for him?
Yeah, right. And then on Sunday, we would play pinochle with my dad and then drive back to Berkeley, you know.
And so, in some ways, your lives were still centered over here rather than...
Yeah, and, you know, I think about that periodically and whether how much I missed or not missed, but most pre-med people were just... busy. The schedule, the requirements now for med school for applying are so different. They're just, I had a guy in my class who was a philosophy major from Stanford, and we had to take everything in the world.
Where did you, so as you're in your senior year at Berkeley, and Gordon Moore's deciding to go to Caltech. How are you deciding on where to go to med school?
Well, what I did was I applied to mostly the West Coast schools, Stanford and Cal, what have you. In fact, the dean of admissions at Cal, I had taught his son to swim in Belmont one summer, and I thought, well, that would be helpful. But the overwhelming number of veterans applying said no, and so that Gordon was really kind. He had been accepted at Caltech, and he was waiting for my acceptance to med school before we had a party about it, and that didn't occur. And then in 1948, nobody believed that Harry Truman would pass a draft law, and he did, and that's when I joined the Naval Reserve. So every week I would go to reserve meetings at Treasure Island, and then while I was waiting for that, we graduated on the 15th of June, and the 25th of June as the Korean War started, and I was a reserve hospital corpsman.
So called up right away?
Right away, yeah. Mm-hmm. I went down to Stanford. My commanding officer thought I should try to get a microbiology degree from Stanford, and I got down there for a couple of months, and our whole division went in, so.
And then you were in Korea for how long?
I was in Korea for a very short time. I was at the Naval Hospital in Oakland, Okno, for a while. Then I got assigned to the Fleet Marine Force and the 1st Marine Division, and I went to Camp Pendleton and all, and we went over for a short time, and then I got assigned to the Navy OCS in Newport, Rhode Island, and I went back there for 4 months, and then...
Time that second?
The second time was longer because of the amount of training that I had to undergo, but the time in Korean waters was very short because we went into the Wonsan invasion, and that was a disaster. So that it cost me about 5 years total. And then when I got out, I reapplied to all the schools. But back east, too. And then we were married. And she was pregnant with my son. And, oh, the admission guys all blew their stack. How could I be doing it? First of all, I was too old. I was 26. I was married, and my wife was pregnant, and you want to go to medical school? You know, they were really terrible. I was teaching at the medical school at Stanford. I was working on my master's PhD, and I took my master's and then went back. But they wouldn't... I could teach in the med school, but I couldn't be accepted there because I was too old, married, and I and the dean of admissions had a nose-to-nose conversation. And next day, Dr. Arthur Miller said, you know, Bob, what you said to him was correct, but he's the dean of admissions, so what we're going to do is we're going to find you a school where they take old people who are married. And I said, that'd be good. So they got me into Hanam in Philadelphia.
Right. Did you... then did your keep in touch at all with Gordon Moore after the war, or
during the war? I saw Gordon and Betty down in Southern California, and I never realized what wartime barracks are in terms of lack of color and what have you. And I remember when they picked me up, we went to a grocery store, and oh, that was just a beautiful thing, you know, it's wonderful. And we drove up to a town down there called Montrose, and that was the name of my ship, Montrose. And that was the last time I saw him and Betty. Now, I don't know, I assume that they must have gotten married while I was overseas or what, I don't know.
Yeah, I think they got married right before they went down to Pasadena.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that must have been right around the same time that you were being mobilized.
Yeah, right. Because we got a whole division when they... Of course, the whole division didn't go in. It was half the division decided if they stopped going to meetings, they wouldn't be called in. And so the commanding officer said, if you don't go, we're going to turn your name into the draft board. Well, they had a female yeoman with an IQ of 1 who typed up the 2 lists and sent the wrong one to the draft board. So I'm overseas, and my dad has 3 U.S. Marshals show up at our house in Redwood City at that time to arrest me for draft dodging. I was the 1st Marine Division, and I had to get a letter from E.O. Smith.
After going to med school at Hahnemann, did you come back immediately to the West Coast?
Yeah, we did. I have a lot of allergies, you can hear the dang stuff, but my wife wanted to stay. It was a beautiful little town called Haddonfield, right across from Philadelphia. And we had made a lot of good friends. But the allergies were just too much. I was almost asthmatic. And so we came back, and I chose Highland, Alameda County, who are in internship. And I applied to about 10. I got accepted at all of them. But what's hilarious about med school is when you get accepted in one school, then all of them want you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, no, Hahnemann did that. They got me right off the bat. That horse were going. We had a AAA map we laid out. And the night before we left, I said, well, we're here. We're going here. And we went to Highland Alameda, which is one of our toughest times. I got $90 a month, and I had to buy my uniforms out of that. And we had two children then. And it was 36 on, 12 off, 36 on, 12 off.
Wow.
But UC San Francisco was the primary people there. And it was, one of Ann's favorite stories is having to divide an egg between the two kids. And it was a tough year. And then I went to Stanford in cancer research, and we got a raise, though. We got $125 a month. And that's where we were there for 3 years.
And then did you go into private practice?
Private practice in 1963, yeah.
In Los Gatos?
Mm-hmm.
Or
mm-hmm.
And did you, did you have any contact with Gordon Moore?
No, because he went from Caltech, my understanding,
mm-hmm.
to Silver Springs, Maryland.
Right.
And he was working on a lot of highly classified things at
sure.
that time. And then when he came back out, he started with Shockley, and then went on, he and I don't know when Andy Grove joined him, but they did eventually go off on their own. And Silicon Valley is a, and my wife, my daughter works in that, she's an HR director. That's a total different world. And so is medicine, a total different world. So we were just different worlds. And the only contact I had was with his brother when they came in, and then his brother's wife would bring the child in. But then that was the last time. And we just grew up in two different worlds. When I did the same thing as I'm doing for yourself in my office with the Alumni of the Year, and they came in and wanted me to talk about what we did at Berkeley too. And then the next time I saw him was at the presentation a few years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did you get a chance to reconnect a little bit at that event?
We talked a little bit, but not a lot. It was a big thing.
Sure.
He was standing outside because nobody knew who he was, you know, and so I saw him at Gordy. He was always known as Gordy Moore to me. So he's a guy who got fat. And so we went in and I sat at the table with his family. he's got the two sons were there.
Right. You
know.
Well, I wanted to then maybe to close with just a couple questions, three, four questions. One is about just to ask you to reflect on the changes that have taken place in this area, in this geographical area, in part caused by your former roommate, the whole Silicon Valley semiconductor phenomenon. How has the region changed since the two of you were in high school?
Well, when we were first here, one of the big things was to come down. When we first lived down here, was to come down for Blossom Festival. The whole valley was just beautiful blossoms of all kinds of fruit trees. And then when we first got here in the middle 60s, or 63, 64, we were still at Stanford, and we wanted to find a place to live. We were going to buy a house or maybe rent, what have you. And we would come down over here, Saratoga, Sunnyvale Road, and the farmers were selling all of their farms for $1 million. And all of a sudden, we had all these millionaires here, and most of the homes, including the here, had fruit trees in the backyard. And of course, they're hard to take care of. And so suddenly, all these blossom festivals just disappeared. There's a few. There's one in Sunnyvale, Olson's cherry orchard, and I think there's only 4 acres left.
Hmm.
And then this new thing. My daughter has been climbed the ladder through all these places. She's vice president of Shutterfly now.
Hmm.
And she has gone through many of these as vice president. In fact, on my roll-top desk that I still have in my office, she had a little chip. I'd never seen a chip before. And so then suddenly the income skyrocketed around here. The orchards disappeared. The pressure increased. The cost of housing was enormous. And they just kept building more and more, and they're still doing it. And so that this whole beautiful valley was taken up by all the chip organizations. And then when the crash came in the middle 90s, I think it was, boy, a lot of people on this block. Well, you got what, you should have bought Google at 800 or something, my God. So we were seeing people like HP. The guy last year made $19 million. Exxon's parachute was for almost $500 million. And I thought, what is this? You know, this is crazy. But then you get over to what Gordy's done, is that one of his comments was hilarious, was he had $20 billion and he put it in four groups of $5 billion each. And somebody asked him about this. He was sitting at one of the meetings and he said, I've never had so much trouble giving money away.
Well, to just to pick up on that comment, you know, do you have any reflections on what this person you knew as a very young man,
mm-hmm.
about what he's been able to do from a technical point of view, from an industrial or business point of view, and now from a philanthropic point of view? Would you ever have expected it?
He said that at his presentation. He said, I was in the right place at the right time. And he attributes all of his position now to that he was there at the right time to get this, and he got into this big wave that was going on. But as far as the technical part is concerned, I mean, it takes my own daughter to show me what a chip looks like. I don't know this stuff. And I don't think he's really changed that much. I think that the huge amount of money that these people make is secondary. As I mentioned to you, I said he's what a CEO should be. He's, I'm sure that he's, I would be surprised to see him holler at anybody at work. Now, I don't know that, but I would be surprised. He comes from a very humble background and very quiet people. And I think he's probably a fairly private person as well. But then when he accumulated, he used to live in Los Altos, and then they moved to Woodside. And it's then when he decided to share all of this enormous wealth with everybody, and did. The building at Berkeley is one, the co-op. some idiot in the cooperative newsletter that comes occasionally was criticizing what has Gordon Moore given to the co-op. A dumb thing to ask, and he had given $100,000. And they had not made any big deal about it. And that's just exactly what you expect. Did I tell you about the United Fund?
No.
Okay. United Fund went sour. They pulled all kinds of stunts to make everybody give more and what have you. And they almost went bankrupt. Wrote a check for $1 million to United Fund and saved them. And never made a big deal about it. And that's the kind of people they are, I think.
Thinking about Gordon Moore's successes technologically and from a business point of view, you know, you would think that he might be competitive or ambitious. Did you see any of those types of traits?
No, I never saw. We have a lot of competitive, ambitious people that we see. You know, I take care of people from this whole area, but mostly in this end of the valley, and they're make enormous amounts of money, you know. But I think the one thing was that they weren't competing because they were the only ones. Mm-hmm. See, in other words, I think Cisco now makes a lot of chips, but Intel always made more than anybody else. And I don't think that it all came. It wasn't a matter of a blatant ambition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Two last questions. One is, you were talking a little bit about Gordon Moore's character, humble, quiet, mm-hmm. private, his sort of values. If you had to answer the question, you know, what do those values reflect, or where did they come from? How would you answer that?
I would say that they came from his family. I would say these were good earth kind of people. In other words, the I don't know whether his older brother is alive or not at this point.
He's deceased.
Okay. But I'm willing to bet that he was a person in agriculture at that level and never made a big thing about it and probably did fine. And his mother and dad were just raised them at like that, low-key people.
Last question is, if you think about the story of Gordon Moore's life, it's a story that's by and large taken place, with the exception of going to Silver Springs and the exception of 2-3 years in Pasadena, you know, 90% of it has happened within, let's say, a 30-mile radius around Santa,
right. Yes. Oh, yeah.
You know, around in the Bay Area.
That's right.
Do you think there's anything? So it is his story is very much a Bay Area story. Do you think there's anything about the Bay Area that uniquely informs his story? Or I'm just trying to tease out the, you know, the Bay Area really is the context for his story, and if you have any thoughts or reflections,
you know,
on that.
In other words, he realized a new device, a chip, which had not been done before. And he realized how important that was. And also, he also came up with this Moore's Law about how many more each year kind of thing, and realized that this is what we got to do. And it wasn't meant as a economic type of thing. He just realized, oh, wow, It's kind of like discovering penicillin and realizing how much it could be used. He discovered this device, and then he also, I guess Andy must have been with him at that time, decided that Shockley was not the person to continue doing this. Mm-hmm. He was essentially crazy. But his intuition, his insight to what he had in his hand was something. At our med school reunion, they had the guys in 50 years who had these plates, microbiology plates, who also saw the mold, but didn't see it killing the bugs. Oh. At the same time as Fleming said, hey. And that's what really Gordon did.
Right, was to have that realization.
Right, yeah, because it's, and then he ended up, as I said before, whatever a CEO should be, you know.
Well, I think that exhausts all of the questions that I had. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I haven't, or any other area?
Remember, that I think we've covered as much as where old minds remember going on, but let's say he was a very, very studious guy in college, for sure. And he, the thing that he's doing now is just phenomenal. There's a group that are buying up chunks of preserved land all over, and he's a member of that group too. And so that every time I turn around, I find something else that he's doing, I think, how neat, how great that is, yeah. Because he's unique. Now, Gates is doing some of this, but as the guy said, you're not JFK, Gates is not Gordon Moore.
Well, great. Well, let me switch this off.